So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
Well, I think the people here have summed up your career in two letters. F-U.
Well, all right, I think I will take it to the people. How many here would like to see the WWE Championship defended in an elimination chamber? Not bad, pretty convincing. I guess, Eric, what you say has merit. Therefore, at the next pay-per-view, New Year's Revolution, we will see the WWE title defended inside the elimination chamber. You will all see it. I will see it. Millions all over the world will see it. It's just unfortunate, Mr. Bischoff, that you won't. Uh-oh. Eric Bischoff! Yeah!
True. Keeping your attention is what I'm gonna do. Hardcore, yo, I can never be soft. Ask them at my death and they say the boy goes off. Building up momentum with a touch of my rhyme. Suckers stay away because, yo, they know the time. Quiet on the seconds I'm about to begin. And if you didn't hear me, boy, I'll tell you again. My name is Easy, or just call me E. But it doesn't really matter to me, cause I'm the same person, whether serious or rehearsing. I just gotta keep cursing. But this is for the radio, so I better...
It is Review Away. I'm John Pollock, along with Wei Ting.
Yeah!
Wei, I couldn't help but notice before we just started that you've got the sniffles. Are you suffering from allergies?
I think so.
I'm getting my ass kicked by them this year.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm allergic to something. Pollen, probably.
Yeah.
Ragweed.
Awful things to probably
dust.
Have really no... Their positives are far outweighed by their negatives.
I guess it's, I think it's, something exclusive to, I certainly, my family didn't grow up with, like, these allergies. Like, in Hong Kong, we didn't have these things. And then, we came here, and all of a sudden...
Oh, boy.
Pollen. Ragweed.
How offensive.
Dust. Why? Why is that offensive?
We're just a dirty country. Full of pollen?
No, it's a... I didn't say that.
I'm just saying. Said I didn't have these problems till I came here.
Yeah.
To Canada.
Okay.
Clean this place up. You could be very well be right.
Yeah.
I had allergies a lot when I was a kid, and then it seems like there's years, nothing. And then this year, my God, I wake up in the morning, my throat feels like shit,
mm-hmm.
I'm sneezing all the time, and then it'll happen later in the day. And it goes up, it goes down...
Yeah.
I took some,
Reactin?
Claritin, I believe.
Oh, Claritin,
did
yeah.
nothing.
That's a good one, too.
Nah, it's not very good. I bought
okay.
a different one
that
now
sucks.
That I'm on. Does nothing. Just...
Does nothing?
These stupid pills, Wei. They're dumb.
Yeah.
All placebo effect.
Yeah, what should we do? What's the cure?
I'm gonna lock myself in a room.
You'll probably
called my house, and I'm never leaving it again.
I don't know if that matters. I think you could still be allergic to things.
Well, at least I can be on my own then.
Yeah, sure.
Just
maybe just put yourself in a glass box.
As long as the ragweed can't make its Wei in. No more insects. I'm done with insects.
Yeah,
I've never had a tolerance for them to begin with.
Oh, you're done with
bees that sting you. They're not held to any kind of accountability.
Yeah.
Though they tend to give their life if they sting you, but nonetheless.
Uh-huh.
Why do we need ants? I think I've had this rant before. I think I've exhausted my hot takes.
Why does the world need ants?
Explain it to me.
Why do we need anything? Why do we need cats?
Some professor is going to contact us and let us know what ants provide the world. But in my 32 years on Earth...
Wait, well, hold on. Why do ants need us? You ever ask yourself that?
Because we're superior.
Says who?
They don't get a choice. We do.
They don't get a choice? What do you mean?
If you come close to an ant, Way, and it's a battle to the death,
yeah.
What are they doing?
Okay, they're running away.
So high volume, they may have. But there's not much they can do to us. So... Okay. They better watch it. That's all I'm saying.
So you basically, you think anybody inferior to yourself doesn't necessarily have a choice of existing?
No, it's more if you bother me. Ants don't tend to really bother me. Hmm. But flies and bees, they annoy me.
They should be extinct.
Well,
yeah.
There will not be one tear shed if tomorrow the headline in the... Whatever newspaper says.
What about like a fan who comments on your Twitter with a negative comment?
Well, these are fleas.
Yeah.
These are human fleas.
They should be wiped out as well.
They're very tiny because you see their follower count, but they're damn annoying. They're not going to kill you, but they're an annoyance. I extract them by muting them.
Got it. Yes. So if only you could mute or block flies.
Yes. There's insects in physical form, and then there's what I call the mutants online.
Ha! Mutants, that's a good one.
So we're going to talk about the Eric Bischoff DVD, someone who was a thorn in the side of the World Wrestling Federation for many years, with both trying to extract the other from pro wrestling existence, a fight to the death.
Yeah.
And then... I guess Eric Bischoff being reincarnated as a character in the WWE years later. So yeah, we are going to go through how Eric Bischoff started out as a caterpillar.
Oh, you're still talking?
Turned into a butterfly.
Oh, God.
And that butterfly effect played out into a very profitable period of time for WCW before the extinction came away. Let's make this all about insects on this show.
Got it. I get it.
Okay. Sports Entertainment's most controversial figure.
Oh, by
figure.
The way, we're giving away a DVD.
We are giving away a pair of DVDs.
Oh, wow.
If you listened to Monday's review of Raw, then you would have heard the first secret word. And then somewhere throughout this show, we are going to drop the second secret word.
Yeah.
And that secret word is keep listening. That is not the word. You're going to have to actually keep listening for what the secret word, not words, are, which will come at any time.
Any time.
Be like an RKO way. Yeah. That's where that secret word's going to come.
Yep.
And as part of our promotional language here, I do have to give a description of these DVDs that someone is going to win. Someone's going to win both of them, and maybe if I'm in a good mood, which is unlikely, but Way will probably be in a good mood, we might give away multiples.
Oh, wow.
So what you're going to have to do, you're going to have to hear both secret words, one from Review or Raw, one from this show, and then you're going to have to send Way a private message on the Law message board. Because I did the last one, and I got way too many responses, and
Yeah, send it to me.
And
waiting.
You can decide the amount of people that win, and who wins.
So you have to join our message board, lawradio.proboards.com, and look for a post that I posted somewhere, and then hit direct message, private message. Is that right?
Yeah. Our goal here is that we're giving you DVDs, so you better download both shows, you better listen to the majority of them, and sign up for an account on the message board. So we want to get something out of you.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, because we, you know... We're
wasps, and we're trying to suck your blood for all it's worth before we...
I don't think that's what they do. I don't think that's what wasps do. They don't suck blood.
Do wasps not suck blood?
No, I don't think so, man.
Which ones are the blood suckers?
Mosquitoes.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of.
Got it.
Yes.
All right. Well, I'm sure the DVD company's really grateful for this plug for their...
Wait, this is prime real estate, okay? Dare I say that Live Audio Wrestling was the number two sports and recreational podcast a few weeks ago in the fine country of Canada.
It was.
So
yeah.
Allow me to flex the muscle here.
All right, you read that. I'm going to blow my nose.
I wanted to tell you about these, Wei.
Okay.
I want to make this message seem personal with you. So
I guess I'll keep this.
I'm going to work this into just a natural conversation with you. So.
All right.
Hey, Wei.
What's up?
Remember Payback a few months ago? This was where grudges were settled and also where new rivalries were born, and it's now out on DVD.
Okay, yeah, it seems about the right time.
You might not remember this show, but it was where the phenomenal AJ Styles took on WWE champion Roman Reigns in your favorite, a no disqualification match. But that's not all, Wei. If you happen to get this Payback DVD, you're also going to get to experience a battle of the bloodlines as WWE Women's Champion and still champion Charlotte is joined by her father, Ric Flair, in better times between father and daughter. And she is going to be taking on Natalya, who is escorted by her uncle, Bret the Hitman Hart. And you, Wei, are not eligible for this contest, so you can pick it up on DVD today. And Eric Bischoff, who is responsible for some of the most revolutionary moments in sports entertainment history. I'll jog your memory, Wei, from creating the NWO to battling the WWE during the Monday Night Wars. You, as my friend, can relive all of Eric Bischoff's greatest moments, and best yet, hear from the man himself in the new release, Eric Bischoff, Sports Entertainment's Most Controversial Figure, available now on DVD and Blu-ray.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for that note.
Don't you want to... Well, I guess you've watched one of these already.
Yeah.
But clearly you're going to leave and watch Payback now.
Yeah, I'm sure it has a lot of bonuses, a lot of extras.
You're almost in Ottawa as we speak.
Yeah, I am.
Are you excited about your trip to the nation's capital for a work trip?
Yeah, for sure. I am.
So, Wei, I'm excited about this contest giveaway.
Me too.
Yeah, it's always fun when we can reward our listeners with something free.
Yeah, I think giveaways are good. Stay tuned, everybody. For the secret word.
The secret word is still to come.
Mm-hmm.
So, here we have Eric Bischoff, sports entertainment's most controversial figure. Now, Wei, when you heard there was going to be a new Eric Bischoff DVD, were you interested to hear more? Because this is a time period that, believe me, if this was a pinata, it's been hit to death at this point by the WWE. Every angle of the Monday Night Wars, which has also been debated, should be singular. It's been exhausted. So here we are going back to this well yet again. Were you anticipating watching this documentary?
I think there's a level of interest anytime there's a documentary release. But would I say that this was one I was as excited for as, say, like a CM Punk or a Paul Heyman documentary? No, not as much. And much of that is for the reasons you discussed, because I feel like I already know so much of this story. I feel like I wouldn't be learning all that much more about the Monday Night Wars. And so I can't say my interest level was huge going into it, but there's always a level of curiosity for any WWE documentary project.
Yes. Eric Bischoff is an interesting character because he is obviously one of the most key power brokers in professional wrestling of the past 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly he's somebody that has... certainly the answers to a lot of questions people have. And I think if you watched his, or read his book, rather, a decade ago, it was a book that I left with seeing that there was a lot of kind of one side of the story. And afterwards, and I went and read these back over the past week, was after that book came out, Dave Meltzer dedicated like a 4-part story to reviewing that book and going through essentially the history of Eric Bischoff in WCW. It's a fascinating series of observers from that time period in November and December of 2006. So I was curious, now that it's a decade after that book came out, where he was very much entrenched with the WWE, and the book also became like a big part of it, why I think Dave Meltzer wanted to set this record straight, was a lot of that book, the tone was those fucking dirt sheets and just railing on the internet, and it became very much agenda-driven, which was interesting because if you watch some of the, I don't know if it was in the DVD portion or the extra portion where Bischoff talks about the interview he did with JBL, saying that was his first interview where he really didn't have an agenda and he was being much more honest, which I think gave hope for this documentary that maybe this is a guy who has a bit of a clearer view on history and could address a lot of interesting things. So I went into this with an open mind about what kind of perspective Eric Bischoff would have in 2016 compared to his reflections 10 years ago.
So you believe the book from 10 years ago was kind of him speaking more on behalf of the WWE, or at least being somewhat censored?
I don't know if censored would be the right term, but I think he was very much speaking from that perspective as a guy that...
an employee.
Yeah, I mean, he had already been written off television by the time the book came out, but he was very much in that environment. There was, and then the tone changed when he went to TNA. And TNA is never addressed in this documentary at all. You would never have any idea that he spent years in TNA. And part of that is that there is also a lawsuit that's technically still ongoing. And Eric Bischoff, in other podcast interviews he's done, TNA really doesn't come up, and I think that's by request of Bischoff because he probably cannot speak on it at this point. And it would also be kind of difficult, I think, to – I mean, what kind of angle are you even looking at here? This focus was that WCW period, and I don't think that TNA
– it has no impact on his legacy.
Not a huge amount. I think it showed people that I think – TNA was not an overwhelming success. It's not like this guy came back and he had magic in a bottle and turned TNA around. But this was not what this DVD was going to be about. And really, the title alone tells you how they want to position Eric Bischoff, the wild, controversial figure, and sell this DVD based on all these people who talk shit about this guy, and this is his response.
How about that photo on the cover? Oh, my God. This, like, man just kind of smirking, big evil grin.
Pointing into his dimples.
Around a ring of fire. Like he was the devil laughing at you.
This is a man that I don't know if you can say he photos well. This is a former model.
He's a model. He comes across like, you know.
But the photos they have of this guy... I don't think I saw one still shot in this entire documentary that did not scream asshole.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
And that's part of the character of Eric Bischoff that makes him such a great on-screen character. He's a very easily hateable character.
Yep. I mean,
this guy can come off extremely obnoxious. Yeah. And that was a great talent for him, especially in WWE, where he was a very great on-screen presence.
Mm-hmm.
So... it started off with clips from the rise and fall of WCW documentary and various people criticizing Eric Bischoff, pointing out all his flaws as a camera is being set up way.
This is really nice. It wasn't just the rise and fall of WCW. It was just a number of clips from all the specials that the WWE's done in the past. And I thought it was really cool how they did this because it was very different from how they usually start off their documentaries. I even like that they included the little keys, the little lower thirds from all these other different projects throughout their history, so you could see just how many people, some alive, some dead, all had an opinion on Eric Bischoff. You saw clips from, you know, people ranging from, an old interview of Chris Jericho to maybe a Booker T to even an Eddie Guerrero, all having an opinion on Eric Bischoff. So from the get-go, you could tell... even for somebody who doesn't know who Eric Bischoff is, they were given the impression that this was a man that had a big impact on the industry because of how many people who had opinions on this guy.
Yeah, and I think the key here, first of all, what this means for the WWE, new Eric Bischoff interviews. Gone is Eric sitting in the bleachers with the Titantron and an empty arena and our 2002... key on the screen.
Yeah, I'm amazed because, like,
they love that interview, eh? That's all they had for all these years when he was gone.
He was working for the company for quite a while, and yet that was the only real sit-down interview that they had done with him for such a long time.
Now we've got exotic locales, various beers being drunk, bonfire Eric Bischoff interviews, him at the bar, him in his in the desert in Cody, Wyoming.
Yep.
And this was... definitely a documentary that was centered around more showcasing Eric Bischoff away from wrestling and who this guy is today. And it was set in the locations I outlined there, primarily in Cody, Wyoming. And we got a lot of Eric Bischoff discussing his outside interests, literally, including horseback riding and riding motorcycles. And
yeah,
this felt like a Wrangler jeans ad at various points.
It came as a surprise to me because, I mean, I didn't really know this side of Bischoff. He really, to me, came across like a city guy. You know, but they were able to portray this guy just in the midst of this beautiful, sprawling countryside and him kind of, you know, treating the environment as a big part of his identity. So it kind of came as a surprise to me. Some great drone shots here. Great looking drone shots.
Yeah. How about that? The camera on his motorcycle.
GoPro.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, it was nice. Yeah. It was really well done. A lot of production involved in this one.
Yeah, a lot of focus on him growing up, where we also heard from his brother, Mark Bischoff.
Right.
And how they grew up in Detroit, not with a lot of money, moved to Pittsburgh and then eventually Minneapolis. He was into high school wrestling.
Spoke a lot about his mentor, Bob Racy, a man who he says influenced him greatly to become an entrepreneur.
Yeah, and also a fact I was not aware of was that his father was severely limited physically. He was paralyzed, and this guy became really a father figure mm-hmm. for Eric Bischoff, and he spoke about him at length there. I mean, this was stuff that you don't... The typical Eric Bischoff interviews, it's wrestling business related and not a whole lot on this guy on a personal note.
Yeah. How, like, this was sort of the origin. If the, you know, I feel like Eric Bischoff is sort of portrayed as sort of a Lex Luthor by the WWE in like, professional wrestling history. Here's the evil, maniacal genius. And this was sort of the origin of Lex Luthor.
Wow.
Yeah.
It was. Man, they showed his brother, first of all, talking about his high school wrestling days, saying Eric was not that good, but he tried very hard, so...
I was really amazed, like, because, like, this early portion of the documentary, they just kind of spent talking about Eric's life prior to wrestling. And I was very surprised at how many different successes he had at such an early age, even before he got hooked up with the AWA.
He had a landscaping business in high school.
At the age of 21, he ran a successful landscaping company.
Then he talked about getting into karate, which that was very well known about him. And, of course, Sonny Ono. Called upon here for a WWE interview, of course.
Yeah, an updated.
Eric got all his buddies in this one. I mean, there was Jason Hervey, Sonny Ono, and I mentioned Mark Bischoff. It's not till like the final 10 minutes of this documentary where out of nowhere appears his sister, whose interview must have just been pretty unusable because they felt one sound clip of his sister, who in a weird sense is... Her name is Lori, and Eric's wife's name is Lori, but they're spelled differently. So we have two Lori Bischoffs.
That's weird. That's strange.
So, yeah, they had PKA footage from 1979 with Eric kickboxing.
That was really cool.
I bet you Scott Coker has some Eric Bischoff stories.
Oh, yeah.
I guarantee
he used to run PKA?
He was involved with promoting kickboxing on ESPN, and just because that was such a small world at that time period when PKA was kind of in vogue... I guarantee you, Scott Coker, knowing who Eric Bischoff became, I'm sure he had some interactions or at least was aware of this guy in 1979. Not that Eric got, it sounded like, to any super high competitive level, but this footage that they had, I mean, it was cool to see.
The fact that he made it onto a broadcast level of kickboxing, I think, is quite impressive.
He was also portrayed as a dirty fighter for his excessive stomping by Sonny Ono. Like, what a dick. You're stomping in PKA.
He's a natural heel.
This guy. I was hoping that would be the footage because they showed B-roll as he's describing this. I was like, oh, my God, are we going to see a stomp here? But they did not have a stomping incident here. And, yeah, this is where I wrote just, is there any photo of his that does not scream asshole? Like, even his high school photo where there's no sense of a smile anywhere near this man with his pre-emo black hair. coming out, like, he looked like he was out of Hogwarts.
He immediately comes across like a guy who, you know, you can make a ton of assumptions for the level.
He's Malfoy.
From, what is that, Harry Potter?
Potter?
I don't watch that stuff. Or like, I mean, any type of kind of, you know, archetypical, good-looking guy who is involved in business, who loves to, you know, who's very charismatic, but you could tell they're disingenuous. Whether or not that's true, I don't know, but that's the first impression you could make of a guy who looks like Eric Bischoff.
Such interesting career paths. We jumped from high school wrestling to landscaping to karate, and the next stop was catalog model. And
he's like an actual Ken doll with like as many careers as Ken.
He had a shocking resemblance to Brad Maddox at this time in his life.
Sure, absolutely.
And this was where he met his wife, Lori, L-O-R-E-E, who was also a model, and Lori is a pack rat and has saved most of their modeling photos, including one
pack rat.
Pack rat. You've never heard of that term?
Just no.
A hoarder.
Got it.
They show a Sears ad with Eric, and there's this one ad where I believe it's the two of them, and both of them forgot their tops for this shoot. I mean, these shots
these
are just something
photos.
Else, man.
Oh my God.
Like, how the fact that Eric opened up these photos for future WWE projects. They have all of these now digitized forever.
Yeah.
The Eric Bischoff modeling catalog, which would have been prime fodder for the WWF 20 years ago, if they had ever got their hold of a Sears catalog from this time.
Well, you can tell that, you know, the guy is not only very confident and comfortable showing these, you know, somewhat embarrassing pictures off, but he might actually be quite proud of them.
I'm sure he is.
Yeah.
There's nothing to be ashamed of, being a model.
He's and a very good-looking
published
guy.
One at that.
Yes.
So, I know sometimes these documentaries, we don't like to go just in order, but I feel it's working for this
Absolutely.
One because it just kind of is interesting to go over, especially this early stuff, because this is the pivot point to wrestling and how he got involved, and it was through his project with Sonny Ono to pitch this game called Ninja Star Wars that somehow escaped any copyright issues.
Yeah, yeah. Ninja Star Wars. It might have been just called Ninja Stars or something, but it looked like a terrible kid's toy where there are these Velcro Ninja Stars and kids would wear these Velcro vests and the game would be to try to throw these essentially Velcro Ninja Stars at your friends. And that was the game. And they played an ad shot from like the 80s.
It looked awful.
For this Ninja Star Wars. It looked awful and it looked amazing.
So he had reached out to Vern Gagne, who had the ESPN slot at the time and wanting to advertise on the AWA. And we even got a shot of Larry Nelson promoting the Ninja Star Wars game on TV.
Incredible. And this Ninja Star Wars is important because he claims that this was his in to the business.
Yeah, from there, and they don't mention it specifically, but it was Larry Nelson who was, I believe, in jail. And they needed to do the TV interviews one day, and Bischoff happened to be there, and he got used on television. And
wait, so he was just the guy selling Ninja Star Wars?
No, he had first got in doing sales.
He got into the AWA doing sales?
Yes.
Because he was...
Through this Ninja Star Wars, it was able to allow him to get into the AWA itself and was working in sales. And this is where he talks about learning all the different aspects of the television business. We heard from Greg Gagne here, which was an old interview, and then getting on to the air when Larry Nelson wasn't there one day. But he went an extremely long period of time without getting paid here in the AWA and was broke at the time. And they did show his WWF audition tape from June 19th of 1990 with Vince McMahon producing him off camera. And I believe he had a mop.
Yeah, I guess Vince had told him, hey, try to sell me this mop. And he didn't get the job.
He didn't get the mop. Or didn't get the mop over.
No.
During his audition.
Did not. But yeah, this was his this whole early portion of Bischoff, even prior to entering pro wrestling, you really do get a sense that this was a man who just pursued his curiosities 100%, whether that be landscaping or moving on from that to karate or moving on from that to, you know, modeling and ultimately ending up in pro wrestling. You could tell that this is just a very driven man who probably would have been successful in a wide number of different careers had he not settled on professional wrestling.
Yeah, I think this early portion especially, you can have your opinions of Eric Bischoff, positive, negative, but I mean, this guy was legitimately bankrupt at one point with a family, and this guy was, you can use the term entrepreneurial spirit, which, my God, you could do shots during this documentary and make a game out of, and Bischoff would probably try and sell it to a syndication company. But, I mean, this guy had tremendous hustle at this point,
yeah.
And you can clearly see that this was a trait amongst very few that can have this kind of an ability to sell themselves,
yep.
And those are some of the most successful people. Mm-hmm. Vince Russo, for all his negatives, an incredible ability to sell himself to people.
Mm-hmm.
And it kept him in the industry for a long period of time because he had a tremendous ability to sell himself. And I see the same thing in Eric Bischoff. On camera, though, he, by his own admission, he was pretty awful in the AWA. And then we take a break. And it was pretty much as close to a commercial break as you get in these documentaries.
They're interludes. And they've done this ever since the CM Punk documentary where they'll kind of combine the present day with, you know, interspersed to break up kind of the chronological storytelling of their histories.
Well, this one, though, I mean, this was his business, but this was an extended ad for Buffalo Bill Cody beer, which I would be curious because, I mean, the DVD market has significantly been reduced overall and especially for the WWE and with the network. I mean, less people are buying DVDs. So there's less money in all of this. So I'm curious if they have now worked out deals such as this where someone like Eric Bischoff, this is somewhat of the compensation as well. Because this was just an ad.
Yeah,
that WWE gets nothing out of this beer company being successful and in their project.
Then again, it is a major part of his present-day life. If you're trying to tell the man's story and what he's up to today, this is what he's up to. He made his own beer.
But this was very, if you're WWE, this is very inconsequential to the Eric Bischoff story, his beer.
Yeah, yeah. But I could see them getting away with it without, you know, paying a cent for it.
Well, we got in-depth descriptions of how he came up with the name. He went on Ancestry.com to learn that one of his relatives was a brewer.
He sold me on it, man. I tried.
Well, you want to try one of these?
I tried Buffalo Bill Cody beer.
Beer is a tough industry, man. To get into just get shelf space.
It just seems like this is a craft beer. I don't know how much...
Does have a nice label to it.
Yeah. I don't know how much of a market they're trying to, you know.
He compares it to Sam Adams.
Okay.
Similar.
Yeah.
And
if any of you have ever tried Buffalo Bill Cody, let us know.
Buffalo Bill Cody beer. But this was shot with, like, all the precision of a 30-second, very nice ad. I mean, just tipping the glass and coming out, the draft.
Takes a sip.
Oh, that's a good beer.
Yeah.
And Jason Hervey is interviewed. I found Jason Hervey so obnoxious on this documentary, and I can't even pinpoint any comments he said. I don't know. It was just, you know, Eric's so smart. He added nothing. That's what I should say. He added nothing to me.
I wouldn't say so.
It was just to me.
No, I wouldn't say so. He's his best friend.
Well,
the guy's talking. He's his business partner. Wayne.
Well, we go into his WCW Wonder Years, where he was recommended to Jim Herd by Greg Gagne to get into WCW, and he had a tryout with Diamond Dallas Page. But there was an issue here, because apparently Eric and Page had had a pull-apart at a bar a number of months back, and Eric thought, damn, this audition, this guy's not going to help me. But instead, Page turned out to be a great assistance, a great asset to Eric's audition, and these two ended up becoming very close friends. And ended up, Eric got the job, and he would start in 1991, and he was the C announcer at the time behind Jim Ross and Tony Schiavone. And he's talked about this in other interviews, and he kind of talked about it here, that he was brought in and designed to make the other guys comfortable because he...
Uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable, yes, sorry. And Jim Herd essentially just trying to put the pressure on these two, and in particular, it was brought up about Ross having a Southern accent.
Yeah.
You know what I don't get about... Whenever we hear it's WCW, it was very regional. And regional, it tends to just extend to, the South.
Yeah.
That's a really large region.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We're not talking about, they only catered to Alabama. No, the South is half the country.
Mm-hmm.
And the South was represented by play-by-play announcers in a variety of sports and were extremely popular broadcasters. So I always find it funny that it seems that Northern is considered global, but Southern is considered regional.
Sure. I wonder what that perception is when you're actually from the South. Is that only because we live in Canada that we have that perception?
I'm sure that there's always that divide, but I think a lot of it is that, I mean, you tend to New York and New Yorkers get a lot of criticism. I mean, they're stereotyping both ways.
Yeah.
I think we can both agree on that. But to me, of the issues with WCW, I never saw that kind of having a Southern voice attached to it impeding anybody from sampling the product.
Well, Jim Ross was the lead on WWE for a long time. I don't think that was.
And he faced the same criticism there, even when, you know, there were Raw broadcasts that set unbelievable numbers.
Your broadcast team was an Oklahoma commentator and a dude from Memphis. I don't think anybody thought twice.
Oh, that Southern Raw product in 99.
And your lead champion was a dude from Texas.
They had old interviews with Dusty Rhodes talking about this time period when he was on the creative team. Appeared to be a new interview with Kevin Nash as well. And they also interviewed Bill Shaw, which is someone I don't think they've ever interviewed in the past for any different projects. He was the WCW president from 93 to 95. And he was the one that, after Bill Watts left through his whole controversy amongst his what can be certainly described as racist remarks at the time, he was either let go or fired. It's pretty much both sides have been told. Then there was a woman put in place named Sharon Sadello, who was there for a brief amount of time, and it was at this point where they wanted to hire an executive vice president to oversee things. They created this position, and that was where Bischoff, as an announcer, threw his name into the ring to be considered here. And Tony Schiavone was another one.
The position I think they mentioned here in particular was executive producer.
Yeah, and then it morphed into he would become executive vice president.
But I guess Bill Shaw here really wanted to turn this into a television product. And I suppose prior to that, there was no real executive producer, television producer role.
And they wanted to get away from having a wrestling person, quote unquote, in this role. I mean, they still had their booker, but this was to be, overseeing the television product. And I think Eric played to that fact, knowing that he could present himself as a non-wrestling guy.
It was really interesting because Bischoff said he was ready to leave pro wrestling. He was just about to move on to something else, but he decided to try and apply for this position, and it surprised him and I think everybody around him when he actually got it.
Yeah, and Bill Shaw here, he noted David Crockett also applied for the position. He didn't mention Schiavone, but he had always been linked to throwing his name in there as well. And I had never heard this story. Bill Shaw, when seeking out this executive producer, called up Vince McMahon to ask for a recommendation.
Yeah.
And Vince didn't have anyone off the top of his head he could recommend.
Is that Kevin Dunn available?
What a weird decision.
It would be weird.
Call your chief competitor,
who
probably could have unzipped his pants and urinated over the phone line at his thoughts.
I mean, if I was Vince,
helping out Bill Shaw at this time.
If I was Vince, I would be like, yeah, here's this guy, and like just get the worst guy possible.
Well, we just got rid of this guy named Murray Hodgson, who's a pathological liar. He might be great in this role. Then we also had, so before we get into his role when he got the job here, we also had Jason Hervey revealing the Kids Team Challenge, which, if you ever want to take a story that really isn't all that impressive and you want to make people think it's impressive, this is the trick, okay, in interviews way. You always say, yeah, so then we got into this, and man, I've never talked about this before. You say that, and all of a sudden it's somehow important. And this could not have been important in the least.
You've got everyone's attention.
you give that, oh, they got me here. I'm going to say this on camera. It was going to be a kids team challenge with wrestlers taking on kids. Dun, dun, dun. Like, what a stupid reveal.
Holy
here.
Holy shit.
I don't even know how this wove into this story.
I didn't even take a note for this.
It was just in the middle of all this. There wasn't even context to this. It was this idea being pitched at the time. Maybe this was his idea before he got the job as the producer job. But it was just a story here from Jason Hervey.
Headline.
He's telling us for the first time.
Headline scoop.
So, anyway, Steve Austin was also interviewed here, and then they go into kind of the financial situation.
Yeah. It was interesting because, like, you had Greg Gagne now react, or you had Vern here reacting to the fact that he was now working for Eric.
Greg. Yeah, Greg was working with WCW at the time, and now his boss was Eric, who was, you know, the little announcer kid that, you know, reported to them.
It was also interesting that Bischoff himself admitted that they might have been able to find somebody more qualified, but I think in retrospect he was able to realize that he was somebody who understood all aspects of the business. Might have not been the best executive producer television-wise, might have not been the best booker, but he knew enough about every little bit to be the most well-rounded candidate.
So this is happening end of 93, early 94, and a man that is very good with statistics and business notes is the one Mookie Ghana on Twitter, and he has a great website, Indeed Wrestling .blogspot.ca, that you can get a lot of these business notes. At the end of 93, here are the average attendance numbers for WCW at the end of 93. In October, they averaged 600. November, they averaged 370 people to their shows. And December, 640. Now, that greatly increased in 1994. And WCW had brought in $24 million in revenue in 93. And they had been losing about $6 million a year. Bill Watts cut those costs significantly. And I believe they lost somewhere around $400,000, so they got their losses down. And one of the biggest things Bischoff did immediately was he was able to finally get revenue, get Turner to pay for their television programming. And they were able to commit to paying them $8 million a year for the TV they produced. So you take that $8 million, and they're already getting into a profitable situation.
What was their deal before?
They were just producing the programming.
For nothing in return? So Turner, what was Turner paying for then?
They owned the company. So it was just you were producing it. But they weren't being treated like a television, you know, production company that's providing programming for you. So WCW on its own is looking at these profits and losses. And that was one of Bischoff's big moves in the following year, was getting $8 million a year. And then they had their first.
So essentially they had an increase in their budget, their operating budget.
Well, yeah, this was, you know, straight revenue for them. They were still producing all the television, but it was very confusing in WCW. And they talked about this, the fact that pay-per-view revenue would come in and it would get split amongst divisions. Like WCW would get a portion, but also you had Turner Home Entertainment, which produced all the home videos and stuff. They would get a portion.
So we're talking basically, all the money is about the same, but WCW wasn't getting the credit for it. Is that right?
Well, it was split. Yeah, like the money that was coming in.
They weren't getting sole credit for it, so it made their numbers look weak.
Yeah, they were just, like you're producing this television, and Bischoff was able to get this great deal where instead of us making virtually, it was something, they'd get very little for their television. Now you were getting $8 million a year, which was essentially found money for them at this point, and then they became profitable in 95. And then you look here at Bischoff's year. In 93, you have $24 million in revenue, and they increased that. In 98, $225 million in revenue. So that's the growth you saw in 5 years. And Eric Bischoff deserves a ton of that credit for growing that.
And then after that, they brokered the Disney deal.
Yeah, he talks about where they would go and do their syndication out of Disney to give it more of an appeal, a family look. The secret word is Copperfield.
And to save costs.
save costs as well. But this was also something, I mean, they didn't stay there all that long. They eventually canceled this because they were doing months of tapings at the time, and it was still, you know, it wasn't all that different from the current setup that TNA has, where they would run at Universal Studios and not charge for people to get in.
Yep.
And it was an image thing.
Yes, yes. Bischoff spoke a lot about that, about how he realized that, you know, doing a deal with Disney might have kind of upset the traditional wrestling fan, but he knew for the perception of WCW on Wall Street to somebody looking to invest in the company, it was a big deal and it mattered more to those people to have a brand like WCW linked to Disney. And, you know, there are portions like this on the documentary that I really enjoy, just to hear somebody talk about the business end of pro wrestling that you don't often get to hear in these types of specials.
So they dedicated some time to their recruitment of Hulk Hogan when he was doing Thunder in Paradise and Ric Flair being a key in that deal. It was also, you know, at this point, around the time that Zane Breslov, who was the infamous promoter, he also came into WCW, and they showed highlights of the ticker tape parade and just showed some brief clips of Hogan from that 2014 interview that they've used throughout a lot. But Hogan, considering how linked he was to Bischoff, had a very minor role in this documentary.
Well, they weren't going to get him for a fresh interview right now.
No, no. But, and, yeah, I can't say it was really hurt by that. I think you have,
yeah,
you certainly had the footage with Hogan that if you wanted to use it, you could. But it was addressed with Hogan and kept rather minimal. And then we go into the creation of Nitro, which is a story that's been told a lot. It was a meeting that Bischoff had with Ted Turner. And Turner was asking why their numbers on Saturday night are not at the level of Raw's. And Bischoff said they're prime time. They're on Monday nights.
It seemed like he was just, like, Bischoff seemed totally unprepared for that type of question. He went into this meeting wanted to talk about an international deal. And instead, what seemed to be on Turner's mind was how they could compete with Raw. And it just seemed like almost a very nonchalant response from Bischoff saying, well, maybe we need to go, you know, we need to be in prime time. He didn't even say head-to-head. He was just saying we need to be prime time and maybe we need to go live. And Turner just made the choice right there.
And it's funny, so many times that when Bischoff tells this story, he always says how then Ted Turner just made the call to clear out 2 hours on Monday nights. He always says 2 hours when the show started off as an hour. It was not 2 hours, but I think that's just a memory lapse.
But, I mean, this just seemed like an incredibly casual decision that basically led to a drastic change in the business. This was the Monday Night Wars right here.
Well, that to me, Ted Turner, he wasn't involved in the day-to-day of WCW. He was not the guy making day-to-day decisions, but he made a series of the most important ones, whether it was purchasing the company when they were, you know, in awful financial shape in 1988, when it was around 92, when other executives, they wanted to just shut down WCW completely, and he basically said, we're not getting rid of wrestling. Don't bother me with this ever again. And then the decision to just give WCW a Monday night slot in 95. So those three key things alone were very important. And they also did have some clips of Ted Turner from that 1998 interview that was showcased on the Monday Night Wars series as well. So you did get a bit here from Ted Turner as well. So, and that takes us into his whole thought process of putting together this show to go up against Raw. And we got some great graphics here, Wade.
This is great. I love this.
This was like a child writing down strategy tips on a piece of paper.
Bischoff talks about how he sat down and wrote all the things he wanted to be different from the WWE. So he had two columns. One was WWE, one was WCW. And he wrote the traits of WWE and what he wanted to be different. So WWE was taped. Well, he wanted to be live. Their age group was 10 to 15. He wanted WCW's age group to be 18 to 34. He called WWE animated and cartoon-esque, and so he wanted to do a reality-based thing. And yes, they animated all this with some After Effects, and I thought it was really well done.
And he talked about SARSA.
SARSA, yes, his acronym.
Story, anticipation, reality, surprise, action. Mm. That was his philosophy when it came to producing wrestling television.
Caught a case of the SARSA.
Yes, yes. So they talked about the this naturally got into the NWO storyline and Jericho bringing up how he was influenced by the New Japan UWFI angle that he had seen in Japan. And they got into the different tactics, like reading the Raw results on Nitro. Alundra Blaze was interviewed really briefly here.
This was all basically kind of like a rehash of the the Monday Night War story, but they didn't go too in depth into it. They basically retold it from the context of Eric describing his philosophies in making professional wrestling television. And I found it very fascinating to hear somebody so involved getting into so philosophical about, you know, the production of pro wrestling.
Yeah, and that was one of the keys at the time as well. WCW had a really they had a sizable audience when they moved to Monday night, and they had a lot of stars as well. So when you it was so different from when TNA attempted this in 2010 under Bischoff.
I really like this portion with like the whole wish list of Eric Bischoff, cuz I mean you see this wish list of things that he wanted to be different from Raw. And I think, again, like we're talking about brand splits, this is the exact type of mentality that I think whoever's running a brand different from Raw should have. Should be writing a checklist like this. What's different and what do we need to make, you know, to make our company stand out? But like you see Eric's list of, you know, Raw's taped, so I want to go live. They're doing animated cartoon-esque stuff, so I want to do a reality-based show. These were essentially the makings of, you know, what we know as modern wrestling today. Live TV, more, you know, certainly the Attitude Era, much more reality-based. I mean, he was basically making up a wish list for what modern wrestling is.
Well, you forget, one's red, one's blue. That's a big difference from Raw and SmackDown.
Raw and SmackDown, yeah. That's pretty much the only difference right now.
They go through, you know, the ups and downs of Nitro, and it's funny because 1998, you look at that year. That was the year where WWF turned everything around after WrestleMania. They ended the Monday Nitro winning streak. And you look at 1998 as this year that, you know, the WWF started to pull away. And it's just, if you just view WCW on its own and you look at the numbers, television numbers, the house show sellouts they had, the pay-per-view numbers they were doing, 1998 was a phenomenal, phenomenal year for this company. It was their most profitable in history. And so much of it is just looking upon the fact that, oh, they lost the, you know, Raw did a 5.0 and they only did a 4.4. And so much of the focus got on that. And Jericho brought up this stretch they had of Nitros. Listen to these figures, okay? This was December. This was a 5-week period at the end of 98 going into 1999. These were episodes of Monday Nitro. They ran one Nitro at the Astrodome in Houston. They drew 32,067. 2 weeks later, this is all right before Christmas as well. Not the most ideal time to draw. The TWA Dome in St. Louis, 28,959, a gate of just over $900,000. And then the January 4th Nitro at the Georgia Dome did 38,809 people and a $930,000 gate. That was three Nitros in the span of like 5 to 6 weeks. Venues that the WWE would only book WrestleMania in today. They were doing these for Nitro at a time when Hogan wasn't even on television at that point. I mean, Goldberg deserves a lot of that hot period. And this was at the time when WCW creatively was a mess. And that Georgia Dome, that was the finger poke of doom, a Nitro at the Georgia Dome. But the business they were doing was unreal. Mm-hmm. And they seemed to get so emotionally attached to this ratings war with the WWF at the time that led to things like Hogan and Goldberg on less than a week's notice, which was a phenomenal show for them. But it's just, it's amazing that you look at the business they were doing in 1998, but creatively, things were totally falling apart in 98. Mm. And Bischoff noted how it was hard to maintain and grow success, and once they had reached that certain level, they tried to grow it by incorporating different celebrities, and they went through Dennis Rodman and Karl Malone, then followed by Jay Leno the following month, which Jason Hervey called an iconic moment when Hogan and Bischoff went on The Tonight Show.
What I love was that, like, you have all this great footage of Eric Bischoff in his heel role with his leather jacket, his motorcycles, the whole footage shot in black and white, him just walking out into the crowd, smirking. And obviously it was done as a, you know, in storyline, but repurposed for the context of this documentary, it just looks like, you know, this evil genius just gloating about his success all the way, you know, until his eventual downfall.
And when the downfall's occurring, you have all the B-roll of him yelling at people, yeah, frustrated on TV that, yeah, they love to use.
So these documentaries are great to see how they reuse that storyline footage to tell real life stories.
Yeah, they talked about the addition of Thunder in early 1998 and the fact that they increased to 5 hours of original. It wasn't even that you can add another two on top of that with Saturday Night and just how much television they were producing at this time.
So. Oh, you thought that was a lot.
But you also look at this point, I mean, yes, they were able to get some money out of Turner. It's nowhere in the zip code of what the WWE now makes off of television. So very different. I mean, what they were producing versus what they were making off of it,
right,
and how they were creatively just numb at a certain point here. And the creative was awful. It was utterly awful by the time you were hitting mid-99 and 2000. I don't even know if a word's been designed yet to describe that year. Bischoff's response to those that have been critical of him: he admits that there may have been more chaos than a typical live television show, but he believed in spontaneity on the show, which you can't say they lacked, and says he would have done it differently, but not a whole lot.
Yeah.
What's that supposed to mean? This did not turn out well. What do you mean you wouldn't have done anything differently?
Perhaps he felt like...
this was not a winning hand by the time you're talking about 99.
Maybe he feels like there's not much he could have done to, you know, prevent WCW from ultimately closing.
He says he didn't think ahead. He admits to not capitalizing on creating new stars and planning for the future, and that he may have gotten too friendly with talent and not use his best judgment. He vehemently disagreed with some old Gene Okerlund comments about giving all the guys creative control, stating only Hogan had creative control. And then he went further into this in the extras, talking about how certain guys were able to talk about certain elements, but it was only Hogan that had definitive creative control in his contract.
I really like this section. And how they did this was they basically showed that opening montage of all these clips, and they had Bischoff watch it and respond specifically to that open. I thought it was really nice because, you know, you have all these people speaking about Eric Bischoff, and you've never really, aside from that one interview, probably done before, a lot of these, documentaries have been done since. You haven't had a chance to hear Eric Bischoff respond until that JBL documentary, until this in particular. So it was nice to get his side of the story.
Yeah, and I mean, Eric Bischoff is very much cast as the villain in a lot of these interviews from guys who have now done quite a turn on Eric Bischoff. I mean, Chris Jericho, who had been critical of him in the past, Steve Austin. I mean, they're largely complimentary of Bischoff now, as you hear, you know, these decade-old comments in some respect.
Yeah, I think something we have to keep in mind was that, you know, these are all people working for the WWE being interviewed at the time. So, you know, especially perhaps in the case of a Gene Okerlund, there might be some, you know, some company loyalty there to, or some pressure to kind of feel like they had to tell the company side of the story.
So they talk about this meeting that occurred at the TWA Dome where Bischoff guaranteed WWE would be out of business in 6 months. And it's Jericho telling this story, and Bischoff responds by saying, quote, "I don't recall ever saying it, but I know I did." And they talk about how he was anxious to be number one, but no one here wanted to see anyone lose their livelihood. And Jericho went on to talk about the complacency of WCW at the time and just how fast everything fell. As I outlined there, the business they were still doing at the end of 98, which was incredible. And then we get into what I thought really lacked on this documentary was just an honest assessment of what led to the demise of WCW, because it's a menu full of things that led to the demise. And Bischoff stating that very few at Turner wanted to see WCW succeed other than Ted Turner and Bill Shaw. Harvey Schiller talked about wrestling being cast aside at Turner. Nash criticized standards and practices, which I think is the least impactful of any of the things that you can really criticize. And then they just went further, discussing lower ad revenue that wrestling programming traditionally has always generated, which is something wrestling still deals with today. Nash brought up the fact that the pay-per-view revenue went to Turner Home Entertainment, which is half true. There was a split, and I don't even know if that extended right until the end, but there was definitely a split. And Bischoff stating that they didn't get the credit for the ad revenue, which kind of counters the previous argument about the fact they didn't generate a whole ton of, or at least ad revenue that was available. And then there was the split involving Turner's programming and sales team that would get money for syndication, and then they talked about the merger as well. So a lot there that they went through. But really, what drove so many people off, it was a really awful product, and that's never really brought up here. It just is presented like, well, we did this incredible business in 98, and then Turner just forgot about us and we self-destructed. And that's essentially how it's played out here. And I don't think it's really an accurate assessment of all that was going on at WCW at the time. It's more just, well, it was out of our control, how we went from generating $225 million to generating $125 million in 2000. And it was just, it was the problem of a merger. It's just, I think there was a lot more that could have been discussed about this, that it was kind of just positioned, well, it was out of our power. As well, we went into the first time he was relieved of his duties in September of 99, and then returning in 2000 alongside Vince Russo, which didn't last very long. He says it was disorganized and screwed up. And then we get into the talks where Bischoff wants to buy WCW in 2000, and it was Jason Hervey who helped him find the financing, and they were able to get Fusion Media on board, and they were getting set to buy the company. They had called a press conference that they were going to buy it, but that never occurred. And then it was Jamie Kellner, after the merger went through with AOL and Time Warner, he was put in charge of all Turner programming, and his first call was eliminating all the professional wrestling. So it made this deal valueless at the point, and it killed them. So Hervey did mention that they almost had a deal with FX. He was able to get a 44-episode deal, but ultimately, they couldn't make that deal, and then WWE swooped in and purchased WCW for $2.5 million and the promise to spend $2 million more on advertising over a decade. So that's kind of a lot there of what led to the demise and just this company that went from making a gigantic amount of profit in 98 to losing tons of... In 2000, they had $125 million in revenue, which is... That's great, but $187 million in expenses. So, I mean, it's just an incredible Titanic-like story to look at where this company went in 2 years and how this ultimately led to the death of WCW at the end. I was just hoping that we would get more of an overall look at the things that went wrong. I mean, you can talk about all these little things. The fact is, this company was ultra-profitable in 98, and it made no logical sense that if you were either side of the Turner or AOL side of things, why you would want to eliminate this. And there were offers made to there was one very prominent offer made in 98 to buy this thing for something like $700 million that they turned down at the time. So if there was this giant decision to eliminate wrestling, we hate wrestling, that was their out, and they opted to stay. So I think it's just a simplistic look to just simply say, well, we were the victim of a bad merger. I'm not saying it had no impact. It certainly did. But there was so much that you could have, I think, looked at here in terms of the
Perhaps maybe instead of, you know, having a whole section about the demise of WCW, which you probably received in many of the other works about the topic, at least some type of more honest admission about creative being a big portion of the fault. Is what you're looking for?
Yeah, I'm looking here. Like, for instance, okay? End of 98, we're averaging 10,243 people. A year later, we're averaging 3,500. And the following year, 2,700. That didn't happen because standards and practice wouldn't allow you to get a fat joke in, or because Turner executives who had no attachment to the creative or anything. I mean, pay-per-view numbers just dwindling. Television numbers. Every business metric was just demolished over this two-year period. And that didn't have anything to do with just an internal dislike for professional wrestling. That was the people that were running this thing day to day into the ground from... You can pinpoint it to mid-98, but it really took hold in 99 when they lost $15 million, and in 2000 when they lost significantly more than that. So, overall, Way, I guess it ends off with how he came into the WWE and getting a phone call from Vince McMahon, and Bischoff paraphrasing that Vince stated, you know, if things had happened the other way, I would hope you would have thought of me and hired me. What a turnaround that would have been.
Vince on WCW
would have been something.
Yeah. And he, you know, this last section really just about his on-air role, and he talks about how he really enjoyed it. He was very grateful for the chance to continue working in the business, and he brings up how, you know, we'd constantly see him get embarrassed on TV, but he says he never really put up much of a fight against creative. In fact, he says that it was him who suggested that Vince throw him in the trash instead of Cena throwing him in the trash.
He was a great sport during those 3 years where he was on television. And he was a great character. And they noted that. He was a very good character during this run in WWE. And Bischoff said he loved his write-off in the garbage truck. Then we got a look at Bischoff Hervey Entertainment. This I felt less... this to me was more of a... I was interested in this, you know, running Bischoff Hervey Entertainment. And we swoop in on a... probably very well-produced meeting ahead of time where they're all sitting around talking business. And it ends with Bischoff having his bonfire with a beer to kind of put everything into one scene.
He talked a little about the JBL interview he did too. But I thought he was in sort of the final scene, he talks about how he believes, Eric believes that now if the WWE hadn't won the Monday Night War, wrestling might have ultimately died. Again, you know, essentially saying that if Turner had won the war, there were executives that would have ultimately gotten rid of professional wrestling anyway, and things like he feels like the WWE Network or the you know, maybe these documentaries wouldn't be around today. So that's his belief.
Yeah, and that's... You know, that's something you can certainly look at. I think WCW was much more prone to cancellation than, for instance, WWE, where it was something that, I mean, they were always... I mean,
it's their only business.
Yeah, which, I mean, WWF was nearly canceled by the USA Network in 97. So, I mean, both sides, I think you look at things, I think structurally you can certainly look that the WWE was much healthier company on its own. But at the same time, when you look at all the resources that WCW had, if you just look on the surface, here you are, you're owned by a massive media company with primetime television and all these advantages that a WWF did not have. I mean, WCW should have been alive and well forever, and yet it wasn't. So I can't say I disagree with Eric Bischoff here, but fundamentally, when you look at all the resources WCW had, that's even more stunning that it ended up the way it did. So that kind of ends the documentary portion. And did you watch the extras?
Yeah.
So there were some interesting stories throughout this. I glanced over here. We did hear from Lori here right at the end of the documentary, confirming Eric had a sister. We learn in the extras that Eric was not much of a fan of school, but he did enjoy learning German, physics, and photography, but was very bad at English and math, and then goes on to a mini rant about today's society, going back to his era when he graduated, and people today that get a trophy, everyone gets a trophy, and no one ever fails.
He said he was grateful for that, because if he had failed school, well, he says he basically wouldn't have been able to pass school without that.
He graduated because society was soft at the time, and they're now reverting back to that softness.
Yes.
He says keeping enough believability and reality in all wrestling stories is what he learned from Vern Gagne. And he was kept in the dark a long time by Gagne, and says that magic does not exist anymore. But I thought this was one of the most interesting answers Bischoff gave, because you really got the sense from him that he still kind of craves that kind of a role as a producer. that I think if the right opportunity presented itself, and it wouldn't stun me at all if he treated this
sure.
you know, working with the WWE so closely yeah. that he would like to be in a role like that with the company.
And I think it showed you how much Vern was an influence on him in terms of professional wrestling philosophy.
He discussed Tony Schiavone. He admitted Schiavone was probably a better announcer than he was, but said he knew the stories and characters, where they were going, and could frame it better on television, very much akin to Vince McMahon calling his own product. And then we heard from Jericho, who said he worked for 17 months in WCW without a contract. And then finally, when they were trying to get him to sit down and sign a new deal, he was the television champion at the time. This was late 98. He would not sign the contract. And Bischoff gave the analogy, if he's ever gone to a Chinese laundromat, he said, no ticky, no laundry. And told him, you're going to be losing that title to Conan. No ticky, no laundry. No contract, no title. And Jericho said, fine, I don't give a shit. It's the television title here.
No ticky, no laundry.
Yes.
That's what I say every time I do the laundry.
You should definitely bring that phrase back.
Yep.
And the final thing here I noted was just where he went further into the creative control criticism and stating that certain characters had an ability to... There was mutual agreement. He said that was probably in Goldberg's contract and just... But Hogan was the one with definitive creative control.
Yeah.
One thing I want to add here, too, it's that you always hear kind of the same criticisms of Eric Bischoff of... You know, things like, oh, he overpaid for talent. I think one thing is really clear when you look at, especially the revenue that WWE generates, which dwarfs what WCW did in their best year. When you look at those numbers and what wrestlers make, I think that to me is more a positive for Eric Bischoff that he, yes, WCW, you can criticize the guaranteed contract model, but that guaranteed contract model worked fine in Japan. And in WCW, I'm never going to get upset that pro wrestlers are making more money. And I think that actually should be a positive for Eric Bischoff, that he paid talent essentially what they were worth. Hulk Hogan may have had a ridiculous contract, but he generated an incredible amount of revenue for that company when he came in and was worth it until a certain time period.
It's an interesting perspective.
So there you have it, Way. That was the Eric Bischoff documentary review. Did you enjoy this?
I really enjoyed this. I thought, in terms of the figures that they've done these types of documentaries on, Bischoff might have been the most powerful figure that they've ever done one on. I thought it was very good, very insightful, and it dealt in large part with the business end of the industry, which we rarely hear about and see illustrated so well in these types of documentaries. Typically, it's, you know, your typical... wrestler who grew up such and such, trained at this school, and then went on to feud with this guy and this guy. But this was totally different in terms of the topics that they covered. I thought that it gave the audience a much greater insight into just how large the professional wrestling industry is, beyond wrestlers and bookers. It's executives, it's TV, it's politics that extend beyond the locker room. Bischoff is just, I think he's a great speaker on camera, comes across, you know, very charismatic whenever he's talking, comes across very genuine. And I could see why, you know, even in terms of business, he might have done so well, is because he's very engaging when he's speaking. And I really liked the documentary simply because it didn't really speak down to the audience. This was a documentary made for people who already knew about the Monday Night Wars, who already had a sense of, you know, what professional wrestling is about. It's not so much a documentary for, you know, somebody brand new to pro wrestling, but they'd find it very interesting as well. So I really enjoyed it. I give it a 9 out of 10.
Wow. A 9 out of 10 from Mr. Ting. I will go 6 out of 10.
Wow.
But, I enjoyed it, but I also had criticisms of it as well. Before we go to the feedback, we're going to hear a small portion of an interview that Dan Lavransky did with Eric Bischoff. This was back in the fall of 2006 after his book came out. So here's a quick look at that interview with Eric Bischoff.
When the book was presented to the WWE, because they've put it out for you, did any stuff get cut out? I have to imagine that Vince McMahon probably wanted to have a look at it before it went out.
On the contrary, I know everybody expected that, including myself. And,
right.
You know, when I agreed to do the book with the WWE, it's one of the things that I pointed out is, look, I look forward to the opportunity to to write the Eric Bischoff story, but only if it's going to be the Eric Bischoff story. I don't want to be the WWE version of the Eric Bischoff story because it's going to have my name on it and my picture on it. And they assured me that, you know, it's my book. I could tell my story the way I chose to tell it. And they lived up to their word and more. In fact, the only real modifications, and there were just only a few, a small handful, were suggestions by WWE's attorneys as to ways that I should present certain information so as not to, you know, put myself at any kind of a legal risk.
Right, right.
Well, that's very interesting. And while we're here, right, with WWE in the present, what's your current status with the company, Eric? I mean, you're back now to promote the book, but what exactly is going on with you and WWE at this time?
Well, technically, I am under contract and will be till sometime around the middle of 2007. I don't remember the date.
Right.
You know, I think the truth is, I've had a great run at WWE. You know, as a performer,
mm-hmm.
You know, I played the role of the general manager for I don't know what it was, 3.5 years or something like that.
Yep,
which is a long time. You know, you start running. You know, creatively speaking, you start running out of things to do.
You sure?
After a certain point, and it just becomes boring and stale. And I think as much as I enjoyed the camera and getting out in front of the audience, you know, I think I was a little tired of the role. Just because I'd pretty much done it all, it was a new territory or new material really to work with. I think the audience was getting a little tired of the character, mm-hmm. as they should be, or should have been. So I think it was just time for that character as a general manager to ride off into the sunset.
We have to talk about the NWO. Basically, I guess where you came up for it, because you talked about Japan in the book, but I was under the understanding, and I could be wrong, that you saw New Japan do some sort of invasion-style angle as well, and that kind of gave you the idea to try it in North America.
Well, it's not quite that. What I saw, you know, I'll back up a little bit. You know, in 93, 94, early 95, I was spending a lot of time in Japan, and at that time, the wrestling business in Japan was extremely strong. They were putting 60 and 80,000 people in the Tokyo Dome for their big shows. They were charging $100 and $200 a ticket, you know, for the seats. It was an incredibly successful era in Japan at that time. So I would go to Japan on a regular basis to you know, in the course of my business, but really to kind of study what it was about the Japanese presentation of wrestling that made it so successful. And what I learned over the course of a couple of years was that, you know, first of all, the Japanese culture is so much different than the American culture or even, you know, Western culture that it would be really hard to import a lot of the formulas, the creative formulas that worked in Japan into the United States.
Mm-hmm.
One example I'll give you is that, you know, here, you know, around the world, particularly in the U.S. and Canada, we all know what sports entertainment is. We know that it's not real. We've had that shoved down our throats now for a long time, and everybody accepts it for what it is. However, in Japan, at least in the early and mid-90s, the audience there believed it was real.
Right, right.
And the media treated it like a legitimate sport.
Yeah, so it would be like on the front page of the sports and stuff like that.
Exactly. So because of the way, you know, the press and the media treated it, because of the way the promoters produced it, it was very, very real to the Japanese audience, which made it a lot easier. So one of the things I walked away from is, okay, we have to make our stuff feel more believable. We've got to take the time, kind of like what we talked about earlier, we've got to take the time and be disciplined and find the right opportunities to create the illusion that what these people are seeing are real.
Right.
Here in the U.S. And that's obviously a lot more difficult because we're all so cynical and so knowledgeable.
Right,
about
right.
Business. So that was one element. And then I had heard, you know, on numerous occasions about different, you know, invasion angles, you know, that had taken place over the course of the years. So as I'm, you know, just kind of learning about the Japanese psychology and what worked and just gathering information, I started applying a little bit of what I was learning to what could happen here in the United States.
Right, right, right.
It all kind of coincided and dovetailed into the NWO storyline.
Right, right, right. Yeah, no, at the time it was absolutely amazing. And it had a great run, but the one thing that I think kind of that kind of unfortunately killed it at the end. Well, there was two things, really. I mean, it got to a point where it seemed like they were just trying to put our NWO shirt on a guy just to try to get him over, and it kind of diluted the whole thing. And the other thing is, you never really saw WCW get their revenge on the NWO, which you would have liked to have seen.
I can't argue with what your perception of it was, but clearly, you know, it wasn't a situation where we were just, you know, throwing shirts on people assuming they were going to get over. You know, on the one hand, I will admit that, you know, the NWO was such a terrific phenomenon that anybody associated with it, you know, became white hot, you know, just by association, at least in the beginning. And I won't deny that there was probably some tendency to exploit that, you know, but I don't think it was quite as drastic as, you know, we were just throwing shirts on people trying to get them over.
Right.
What was really going on behind the scenes was that, you know, I wanted two brands. I mean, let's face it, you know, if we're going to be honest about it, you know, the NWO was really my opportunity, if you will, to create what everybody wished they would be able to see but never would, which was WCW versus WWE.
Right, right.
That was never going to happen. The next best thing was to create my own kind of organization that people felt, you know, we could create our own war with.
Right.
And much like, you know, the WWE split into two separate brands between SmackDown and Raw, the NWO, because of its success, was really going to be our entree into creating our own separate brand.
Right.
Which is why we gave it its own pay-per-view. The NWO sold-out pay-per-view was our first attempt to try to create, or our first step, I guess I should say,
right,
in creating our own separate brand. The WCW Thunder Show was originally going to be an NWO show. Well, if you're going to create two separate brands and have two separate pay-per-views and two separate television series, you clearly have to have a much deeper roster than three guys.
Right, sure, of course, fair enough. Now, one of the other things I found very interesting in the book as well, and probably I would assume a lot of wrestling fans didn't understand this or wouldn't have known this, is that when they came to you with Thunder, you knew right from the start that it was a mistake and that it would oversaturate an already pretty oversaturated marketplace, and that you actually didn't want Thunder to happen.
No, I didn't want it to happen initially, but I think, you know, my nature is, you know, it's almost a flaw. I'm so loyal. I'm loyal to a flaw. And when I take somebody's money and you know, they feed my family, you know, my job is to deliver, regardless of what it is. I may not like it. I may not agree with it. I may not support it, but I don't really care. You know, my job is to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as I'm taking your check, I'm going to do my job. And when I got, you know, my marching orders to do Thunder, I knew, well, I didn't know. I don't want to make it sound like I knew for certain, but I felt deep down inside that it was going to be the straw that broke the camel's back, and I think in many ways it was.
And now, Wei, we will go to the Law message board and read some feedback to those that saw this documentary or had some thoughts on One Eric Bischoff. We start off with Ronaldo from Milan, Italy. Truth be told, between DVDs and shoot interviews, I probably watched a dozen or more pieces on Eric Bischoff, and really, it's the same story we've been told in other DVDs like the WCW one, Monday Night Wars one, and any other bio on wrestlers who were active during that time period. WWE, of course, has huge production values, and the stock footage about Eric's karate matches and old Ninja Star Wars commercial made this the definitive, and I hope, last look at the guy and the rise and fall of WCW. I've always seen Eric as a Vince McMahon doppelganger, kind of same humble upbringing and same desire to succeed no matter what. Say what you want about the fall and ultimate death of WWE's only true rival, but I consider the guy a genius in the same form of a McMahon and a Paul Heyman. Good documentary.
John from Indianapolis. I don't have the network, and I don't have the DVD yet. I'm hoping to win it in the contest. However, based upon what I'm hearing, it's at least a breath of fresh air to know what they were able to get, that they were able to get new interviews with Bischoff. Question about him. Do you feel like WWE gives him too much, too little, or just enough credit with his accomplishments? The WWE mythos about WCW is almost always negative and basically describes Bischoff's success as artificial due to having access to billionaire Ted's pocketbook.
I think it's altered over the years. I think there's been times that he wasn't really given enough credit for what he did. But there's also the criticism that his peak years as a guy running WCW, the success was ultimately a short window in history. And you can argue
he did a significant amount to grow the industry at a time when wrestling in the U.S. was not in a hot period. He helped to change that around. But he also had a hand in everything falling apart, which you could argue did more damage than good, all in all, because at the end of it, we had a national promotion that disappeared. And not all the blame is on his shoulders for that, but he is in that discussion as well. But certainly influential. I think no one can deny that. And I think this DVD, it kind of showcases that the WWE is at a point where they are acknowledging what Eric Bischoff did. And I would state that, you know, this is probably a guy that will get that treatment 1 year for a Hall of Fame induction and and be presented as that, as one of the architects of that time period in wrestling. We go to Chris in Ottawa. I hope they used a David Copperfield-like picture of Bischoff from the Monday Night War throughout the presentation. I was curious what your thoughts are regarding Bischoff's apparent desire to not only have the more popular product, but to wipe out the WWF entirely. Many top WWE people cite that motivation as being the defining moment where WCW became the bad guys in the war. Do you feel the same, or do you find these protests just a bit sycophantic? The McMahons aren't exactly pure of heart. To me, it always seemed like they finally got a taste of their own medicine. Three cheers for the beautiful Eric Bischoff and his misguided pursuits since WCW died.
Wait, did you?
I feel like that's business. You know, I don't know if you ever want to necessarily.
Bischoff got obsessed with it. I think that's certain. When the ratings started to change, he definitely got obsessed.
Don't you think Vince wanted to put Ted Turner out of business?
I'm certain that that was the motivation from both Vince McMahon and Eric Bischoff at the time. What I never understood, like, I can get that mentality, you want to beat your competitor. If you were a performer in the locker room, I couldn't possibly understand your rationale for wanting the same outcome. Mm-hmm. That makes no sense to me as someone that you want as many employers out there as possible. And for a national company to disappear, I think that's completely ludicrous if that was your thinking at that time, to try and put the other out of business.
We go to Rob in Charlotte, who says, the Bucks may say Eric Bischoff, but after completing the documentary, it just felt like the WWE scraping the bottom of the Monday Night Wars barrel. It was interesting getting to see the man Eric Bischoff rather than the character, but in the end, WWE is smashing open the WCW piggy bank to collect the remaining loose pennies. The WWE has their documentary production down to a T and make great use of the archive footage in their library, and getting folks like Bill Shaw and Sonny Ono was a great touch. 6 out of 10.
And finally, Ram from New Jersey. Not much to say about the documentary since they have covered Eric Bischoff many times in all the Monday Night War content. I have to say the WWE production people do an amazing job at matching all the B-roll clips to these documentaries. They have a clip for everything. I wonder who sits there and finds these. That's the documentary I want to see about how they make a documentary.
Oh, yeah.
That would be something. All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for your feedback. You can always leave it at lawradio.proboards.com. And we're going to wrap up the show. But next week, Mr. Ting, you are going to be away.
Yeah, I won't be here. I'll be doing work in UFC in Ottawa this week. So, John, you'll have to find somebody else.
Well, I found someone else, Way.
Oh.
Next week on the show, returning, live in studio, will be SureDog.com's Jordan Breen.
Yeah.
Who will be on the show. We are not sure yet what we are going to be reviewing. I have left it to Mr. Breen to decide an event, but he has promised it will be awful. So we can look forward to that next week on the show. And Mr. Ting, have a great time in Ottawa. You'll get to see Rory McDonald and Stephen Thompson live, which should be an outstanding fight this Saturday night.
Yeah.
So that is all for us, folks. You can go to liveaudiowrestling.com and you can download The Law from Sunday Night, a special bonus show that went up Monday afternoon with Nate Milton and Brian Mann reviewing TNA Slammiversary themselves, plus review a Raw from Monday night. And then coming up later this week, we'll have new editions of What's Next, Bauer and Pollock, the MMA Report, all that great stuff. And then we got Money in the Bank this weekend. So tons of stuff to look forward to. Way is off to Ottawa. I am not going anywhere. So we will chat with you next time on the show. Oh, I forgot. To end this show, I did some digging, Way, and I found an interview that we had live on The Law in 2003 with one John Tenta. Earthquake, Shark, Avalanche.
Yep.
And this is going to tie everything together because he's going to address his infamous promo from 1996, stating what he is and what he is not.
Oh.
And tying it into Eric Bischoff.
Okay.
And making a challenge.
Cool.
So we're going to end things off by hearing John Tenta on The Law from 2003.
Was it, I guess just after realizing that these gimmicks they were giving you weren't working, that in WCW for your last little bit there, they let you actually wrestle as John Tenta? Was that because they finally realized that these gimmicks weren't working, or was that something that you wanted to do just to try wrestling under your own name?
Well, no, you know, everything in my career has, you know, there hasn't been a whole lot that's been left up to me, so that was their decision.
Mm-hmm.
They took the gimmick off me, you know, everyone makes fun of them. I'm not a fish, you know, I'm John Tenta.
Right, right. I remember that promo.
That promo, and, you know, then they got me wrestling as John Tenta, which the people, I believe, were starting to get behind a little bit, but, of course, I obviously wasn't in the correct clique, or I wasn't kissing the right person's butt, and, you know, that got thrown out the window. Me and Boss Man, Big Bubba,
that's right,
was wrestling as they were supposed to have a match at the pay-per-view up in South Dakota, and they canceled it for no apparent reason. I just felt like Bischoff, I pretty bitter with Bischoff, basically. Mm-hmm. I just felt like he wasn't giving me a chance. I don't think he gave a lot of the WWF wrestlers that came down to WCW a good chance.
Right.
You know, with the exception of Hogan, Hall, Nash.
Yeah, it seems for a lot of them he just tried to repeat their WWF gimmicks and hope that might work.
Yeah, and I feel that a lot of it would have worked if he had given them half a chance, but I think he was bitter in the fact that Vince knew how to make stars and he didn't. And,
right.
Going down, you know, he was kind of damaging WWF at the time, and but he could have done a better job by giving the guys a better push down there. He was trying to convince the people that his WCW guys that he had were better than Vince's guys that were coming down.
Yeah, absolutely. We have to wrap things up quickly here, John, but I have to ask you, of course, about your final run in the WWF there with the Oddities and the Golga gimmick there. How did you enjoy that final run?
I at first I didn't enjoy it when we were the big heels, and then when they turned it into the funny babyface
right.
gimmick with the insane clown posse music and the people got with us, then it was enjoyable. If the people aren't behind you, it's not a lot of fun to be out there. And at the time, we had the Jackal out there, and he was trying to make himself the star of this big gang of 7-foot giants.
Right.
And I think he went about it the wrong way. He should have been a little more Jimmy Hartish and let the wrestlers be the stars. You know?
Right, right. All right, John. Well, I thank you for dropping by. And just one last quick question before we let you go. Of all the gimmicks that you've worked through the years, which one do you think worked the best for you?
Definitely Earthquake.
All right.
I wish I could be Earthquake one more time before I get too old, but
well, you know,
like it will happen.
You never know, John, with WrestleMania 20 around the corner and the thoughts of, you know, celebrating a lot of the stars of the past, you very well could get a phone call in the next couple of months.
I'm going away from the other stars now, but any chance I get, I always try to plug and say, Vince, you know, if you're listening to this, I'll do a match for free against Bischoff.
Whoa! You go. You heard it right here. John Tenta challenges Eric Bischoff.
Perhaps to a shoot fight.
Exactly. For free. No charge.